O unique God of all, the Lord of Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad. We call upon your name this evening as we come to break our fast.
According to the teachings of Islam, Ramadan commemorates the revelation of God's word in the Holy Quran to the Prophet Muhammad. The word has become the foundation for one of the world's great religions.
You said recently in your old church, our national leaders are sending U.S. soldiers on a task that is from God. Are we fighting a holy war?
You know, I don't know if that was my exact quote.
Exact words.
As again we say, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. Give me a break. Something happened on the road to Damascus. John fell off his horse, but he got back up on the same horse.
Well, it's all you can read about, all people are talking about. People are worried. In fact, when people like the Fed chairman and the Treasury secretary get worried, you see the looks on their faces when they go on for interviews, when they're appearing before Congress, and they're saying stuff like, we'd better do something now, and we'd better act big now, or we'll be sorry, sorry, sorry later. And you start to wonder about your stock portfolio or your retirement or your IRA or your mutual fund, and you say to yourself, how deep can this go? Economics is a complicated business, and it appears that it was complicated, even too complicated for those we trusted with our mortgages or with the money that was passed back and forth. What's going on? I don't understand it. I'm pretty sure that few people, except the most expert minds, really do. We're going to try and figure it out here in the first few minutes of Issues Etc. We're going to talk about the economic crisis and family-friendly economic policies. Jennifer Roback Morse will be our guest. Thanks for tuning us in. I'm Todd Wilkin. Now, you can join us for the next hour. 1-877-623-MYIE. 877-623-6943. We're coming to you live this Wednesday, September the 24th. A little bit later in the program, we'll talk about creation, incarnation, salvation. Pastor Charles Lehman, author of the book, God Made It For You, he'll be our guest. 1-877-623-MYIE, talkback at issuesetc.org. Jennifer Roback Morse is the founder of the Ruth Institute based in San Diego. She spent 15 years teaching economics at Yale University and George Mason University. She's author of the book, Love and Economics and Smart Sex. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on, Todd.
How bad is it, really? I mean, from the viewpoint of an economist?
Well, it's pretty bad, Todd. I've been concerned about it for a little while, actually. Partly it's the problem of overextension of credit. I mean, really, truly, it's a classic credit overexpansion. You know, if you look at what you teach beginning students of economics, you know, if you expand credit too much, you create a business cycle by people making loans that are not really worthy credit risk. If people do that all at the same time, that's when you generate a credit cycle and a business cycle. I mean, that's classically what a business cycle is, that you've overextended credit to people who are not good risks, and all of those bad loans kind of come due at once. I mean, the puzzle is why should everybody make the same mistake at the same time? That's what a business cycle appears to be, is everybody making the same mistake at the same time. And that is what has happened. What has happened is that in a couple of different ways, the government extended credit in ways that it should not have, and now we're paying the price of that. And I think there are two separate things going on. One, of course, is the Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae. I always get those mixed up. It's sort of like she sells seashells and stuff. But anyway, you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae have been in the business of making loans and encouraging others to make loans to people that don't really have the assets to pay them back. And so you've got that whole line of policy going on there. And then going back even a little bit further, I actually think that around September 11th, 2001, the policymakers really didn't know what that was going to do to the financial markets. And so one of the things they did just to be sure was to pump a lot of credit, pump a lot of liquidity into the market in the hopes that that would kind of stabilize things for a while. And so that was probably right at the time. But overall, what you've done is you've given a lot of people a lot of incentives to make loans that are not sustainable loans that people really don't have the prospect of paying back. And some of those were private homeowners, and so they're having problems with their homes, but others were business-type loans as well. So in all of those cases, as the credit market starts to tighten again and people start to feel the pinch of, gee, things aren't going to go up, 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 up forever, then people can't make those payments, and then things start to get complicated and difficult. And so then everybody pulls back on their loans, and you end up where we are now. So I think we've got a few more months of shaking out here, to be quite honest, regardless of what the bailout plan turns out to be. There is going to be a period of time where this is going to have to shake out, because not all the bad loans are done. And that's what ultimately has to happen. You know, the people who made loans that really shouldn't have been made the loans in the first place, that really didn't have the assets to pay back or the prospect of the income to pay back what they borrowed, there are still, I think, more of those people that are going to have to get kind of squeezed out of the system, you might say. I think the worst is over in that regard, but I think there probably is still some more to come.
What role did greed play here, in your opinion, not only from the, I guess we'll call it the consumer, but also the lender's side of the equation?
You know, honestly, I don't think it was unusual greed. You know, I mean, yes, there was greed involved, but there's always greed involved. You know, every person who buys a house thinking that it's going to appreciate in value, you could say that person is greedy. You know, every person who makes a loan thinking it's going to pay back, get paid back, and they're going to make interest on it, you could say that person is greedy. I don't think there was exceptional greed going on here, with one important exception to that, and that is that the political figures involved in Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, those people, I think, were unusually greedy, probably, and were insulated from ordinary market forces. They got away with it for a long time, and now the bill is coming due for them. So those Washington figures who were responsible for maintaining and regulating and, behaving ethically within those, you know, quasi-government, quasi-private institutions, those are the people that I think are the most suspect in this whole scenario. I think your average mortgage lender is probably your average guy next door, just like your average homeowner who's now foreclosed is not a more than average spendthrift type of a person, if you see what I mean. You know, I mean, I think there's a certain number of, you know, kind of ordinary mistakes that got made, but I don't think those people are extraordinarily to blame. I think if anybody, it's Freddie and Fannie that would be unusually greedy and unusually culpable in this situation.
The numbers stagger the imagination. I mean, you get enough zeros after a figure takes up an entire width of a newspaper column, just the figure for the payout. If it's written out with all of its commas and zeros, people start getting a kind of, their eyes glaze over.
Yep.
So
yep.
I asked you before how bad it is. How big is this? Is this the kind of thing that the average healthy American economy can take on a regular basis?
You know, you certainly can't take it on a regular basis, that's for sure. But what is it going to mean in this particular case? You know, it's too soon for me to say what the package is actually going to look like. I mean, I think that the amount of taxpayer money we're talking about really is staggering. But it's also the case that a lot of the costs could be hidden in the sense that if you end up with the Secretary of Treasury having unusual powers that he maintains after the crisis is over, that could end up being, in the long run, even more damaging than the 7 with all those zeros behind it. And so the details are extremely important in this thing. I mean, I think when people say we're going to do a bailout, what they mean is they're going to somehow cover over this liquidity crisis and that taxpayer money is going to be involved in that. And I think, you know, this is a big version of the FDIC, you know what I mean? But it's such a huge version of that that it really does stagger the imagination. But along with it are the other controls that are being put into place, and those may be necessary here for the short-term situation, but the real question is going to be, what is it going to look like when we're done? What are the overall rules going to be looking like that we're going to be living with for the next 10, 15, 20 years? That's, I think, the real question. I couldn't tell you right now, you know, is the plan we have in front of us at this moment a good idea or not? I couldn't even begin to tell you.
Okay, I want to talk about the family aspect of this.
Okay.
But coming back just for a minute here before we take the break, just a minute, to the greed question. A family says, hey, you know, we could buy a house at, let's just throw out a figure, that for $150,000. But golly, that house at $300,000 looks so good. And it's the dream home we've always wanted. The bank is offering us this very interesting interest arrangement that looks like we're really going to be able to do this. And after all, we got two jobs and we're able to afford all the cars and everything. Is the American dream been overblown for the average American family? 1 minute.
I have to say, yes, it has been. And we are addicted to credit. We are addicted to debt. And I think that there are a lot of people who are to blame for that, including the realtors and the credit card people and all of that. But in the end, the average person has to ask themselves, am I borrowing beyond my means? Do I really have the capacity to pay this back? And so the accumulation of debt in the American economy really is a combination financial crisis and moral crisis. And, you know, you hate to wag your finger at people because I know a lot of people feel they've been victimized. But the fact is a lot of people borrowed thinking that their home prices would always go up. And there's no reason any reasonable person should think that prices will always go up, you know. And so the experts who told them that that was likely are culpable. But in the end, so is the person who took out that loan.
We're talking with Jennifer Roback Morse about the economic crisis and family-friendly economics. What kind of questions or comments do you have on the economic crisis? 1-877-623-MY-IE, 1-877-623-6943, or talk back at issuesetc.org. We'll be right back.
Money. Get back.
Here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Help inform your fellow parishioners about Issues Etc. Issuesetc.org, click promote, and copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. We update this paragraph weekly. Issuesetc.org.
We've got nothing against bumper stickers, just bumper sticker theology. And we'd like to send you the new Issues Etc. bumper sticker. You'll find the Issues Etc. logo, slogan, and website address. Simply send your request to Lutheran Public Radio, 1600 Gulfview Drive, Suite 230, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please include a self-addressed stamped envelope. Good theology doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, but you can tell people where to find good theology. The new Issues Etc. bumper or window sticker.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Should babies with Down syndrome be aborted?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
90% of the couples whose unborn child tests positive for Down syndrome end up aborting that child. This trend is even more alarming considering that some prenatal tests for the condition return a false positive at least 5% of the time. In addition, the quality of life for those born with Down syndrome has increased significantly, with their life expectancy more than doubling since 1983 from 25 years to 56 years. It is tragic that so many unborn children are not given the chance to live for that long because of a diagnosis, or maybe even a misdiagnosis.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. For more about our work to mobilize and advance pro-life women in politics, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Because I'm in debt up to my nose. I make a lot of money, but I don't know where it goes.
We're talking with Jennifer Roback Morse, founder of the Ruth Institute based in San Diego, about the economic crisis and family-friendly economic policy. She spent 15 years teaching economics at Yale University and George Mason University. She's author of the book Love and Economics and Smart Sex. What kind of questions or comments do you have about the crisis or about the policies of our government, be they economic or tax or laws regarding marriage and family, that could help the family out? 1-877-623-MY-IE, 1-877-623-6943, or talk back at issuesetc.org. Jennifer, why should the government have an interest in encouraging the family, that is, mom, dad, and the kids?
Well, if you're going to talk about it from a, simply from a fiscal point of view, the alternative to the family is not a bunch of happy individuals wandering around blissfully. The alternative to the intact family is a situation where you have people who really can't take care of themselves very well, and the government ends up taking care of them. So a report came out earlier this summer that estimated the cost of family fragmentation in the U.S. at around $112 billion per year, including federal costs, state and local costs, and that included in my opinion, that estimate is an underestimate, but it included things like the increased cost to the criminal justice system, increased expenditures for income support, increased expenditures for health care, things like foster care, welfare, all those type of things that are included that are so much more likely when you have family fragmentation than when you have an intact household. And it also included some estimates of the foregone tax revenue. You know, in other words, people who are barely getting by because they're having to do everything themselves and have no family support, those people don't generate as much wealth or as much income, and so they're not as effective at producing the income that the government can tax. So in the end, the society needs a wholesome, healthy, functioning little community of the family in order for the whole big picture of society to function well. And what the family doesn't do, the state will inevitably be called in to do at great expense to the taxpayer, and of course not nearly so effectively as the family would have done in the first place. So for all those reasons, the state really does need to be concerned about the health of the family.
1-877-623-MY-IE, your talk back at issuesetc.org. Rob is up. He's calling from his car. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well.
Hey, my thing is I'm not an economist. I'm just a plumber. But I've noticed in the last few years, since the gasoline prices have gone up, groceries have gone up, my utilities have gone up, my personal property tax has gone up, everything's escalated to where, you know, I used to go out and eat once a week. Now we go out once a month. And I'm looking to see who's going to bail out that waitress that used to get my money once a week. Now she gets it once a month. To me, people bought their houses and they could have made the payments. But now with everything's increased, they're struggling on their mortgages. So I don't understand why the banks don't work with the people so they don't lose their houses and somehow make their loans affordable.
All right, Rob, it's a great question, a kind of a grassroots question. Jen, your response?
Well, Rob has pointed out a couple of things. One is I have to say that there are quite a few lenders and banks that are trying to work with the homeowners in order to restructure their loans, because they're figuring out that there's really no benefit to them in kicking everybody out of their houses. You know, then they get nothing. They don't, you know, it would be better to get some kind of payment on the loan rather than to wipe the person out completely and get nothing. The banks are coming up in some neighborhoods. They're in situation where there are a number of foreclosures in the same neighborhood, and then the value of all the property in the neighborhood automatically goes down. If there's even a single foreclosure in a neighborhood, it hurts the property value of everybody. And so the banks are figuring that out, and you know, realizing that it's in their interest to some extent to try to work with people. But in a lot of cases, that's too little, too late, and they have. There has already been quite a bit of suffering in order for them to come to that conclusion that they need to help people. So that's part of it. The other point that he raises is the gas prices. The gas prices, let's remember, really didn't take off until this spring. You know, it was a big surprise for gas prices to get to $3 earlier this year. And so there have been, yes, gas prices are on the rise and going up, but I don't think that's enough to account for the gouge or the dent in the standard of living that so many people have experienced that has turned out to have these catastrophic consequences. The big thing has been people had these loans that had the teaser introductory rates, and then that those rates changed and the adjustable rate part kicked in, and all of a sudden they had a mortgage payment that was a whole lot higher than they expected. They weren't able to go back and refinance it another time in order to get rid of that. And that's the thing that has really, I think, wiped people out. More than an increase in gas prices, as significant as that may be, I think the thing that's really driving this thing has been some of these creative loans kind of coming due in various ways, and people don't really have the assets to pay back what they borrowed.
Let's talk with Karen. She's calling from her cell. Thanks for waiting, Karen.
Hi, Todd. Thank you for taking my call. I'm so glad to hear her talk about this because I've been screaming and yelling at radios and newspapers about this, that the blame ultimately and sadly ends up with the people who borrowed the money when they shouldn't have. And then now those of us who have been more fiscally responsible are going to end up really bearing the load for them.
Yep, no doubt about it.
With taxes and stuff. And I guess, and I try not to be angry, but I am.
All right. Thank you very much, Karen. Some brief thoughts on that, because I have another email I'd like to share with you.
There's no doubt about it, Karen, that one way or the other, you're going to be paying for it because you pay for it. You're going to pay for it in the taxpayer bailout. As a taxpayer, you may end up paying for it. But if they don't do anything and more homes foreclose, the harm that will be done to the value of the property of the fiscally responsible neighborhood, the neighbors within that neighborhood, people are going to take a hit there anyway. So they're trying to figure out some way to sort of soften the blow overall that is not dreadfully unfair, although there's big elements of unfairness to the thing all around. But they're trying to ease the blow so that things don't collapse and so that you don't have such a strong liquidity crisis that everybody's running around trying to get their money out and all this kind of panic behavior. You want to put a stop to the panic behavior. And I must say, I continue to be impressed by the stability of American financial markets compared to the 30s, for example. You don't have people pulling out all of their money. You don't have people jumping out of windows. You know, all these things that you heard taking place in the Great Depression. You know, people are much calmer, comparatively speaking, from what you heard that took place during the Great Depression. I mean, I think people have the attitude that, you know, okay, we're going to wait and see, we're not going to panic, and usually that's the right thing to do, you know, to kind of, at the very least, remain calm, even if you do think you need to, you know, buy or sell or whatever you think you need to do in your particular case. There is much less sense of panic, at least overall, I think, compared to historical standards, and that's a good thing.
We got about 30 seconds for a response to Daniel in Minneapolis, where he writes, what would happen if the bailout didn't occur? I've heard through a local talk show that because of the way the financial institutions are all connected, that everyone's retirement funds would be at great risk. Is this true? Could you talk for a moment about how this works? Only about 30 seconds or so.
Well, your retirement funds are no more at risk than anything else in this whole thing. And what I mean by that is that everything that is in stocks, as the stock market goes down, of course, the value of those accounts are going to go down. So retirement funds aren't especially at risk. You know, they're not particularly more at risk than anything else in this thing. If you're a person in your 30s or 40s, you don't have to worry as much because you've got some time to recoup from it, and that's what people typically do when they make long-term investments in the stock market. So, you know, you just kind of take a deep breath and go with it and, you know, listen to your financial advisors and, you know, do your best to weather it. People who are closer to retirement, prudent investment strategy all along would have been to be gradually moving out of the more volatile stock investments and into things that are a little bit more stable. So most responsible financial managers have already done that and are already doing that for their clients. And so I don't think you need to be especially worried about your retirement funds. I live in the city of San Diego, where our city retirement funds are always a mess precisely because the city overpromised what it could pay. There's a real fiscal crisis for you. Relative to the person's average 401k and IRA contributions, the government, these city pension funds are in much worse shape, by and large, than the average person's 401k. So I wouldn't get hysterical about it.
Hey, Jen, can you give us about another 5 minutes on the other side of this break?
All right.
All right. We're talking with Jennifer Roback Morris, founder of the Ruth Institute, based in San Diego. We'll get to some email from Bob in Newport, Vermont, after this break, and some questions on what specifically the government can implement by way of family-friendly policies that will continue to support the family in good times and in bad times. Jen spent 15 years teaching economics at Yale University and George Mason University. She's author of the book Love and Economics. Our call-in number, we're coming to you live this Wednesday, September the 24th, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-MYIE, or email us right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org. talkback@issuesetc.org. Just a few more minutes with Jennifer Roback Morse, and then we'll be talking with Pastor Charles Lehman, author of a children's book called God Made It For You. We're going to talk about the connection between the creation, the incarnation, and your salvation. You'll find a link to the Ruth Institute on demand on the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org. Look for that link to the Institute under the on-demand section. We'll be right back with Jennifer Roback Morse.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
A lot of us across this country are really thankful to be hearing your voices again.
Dr. Albert Moeller, president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, with his thoughts on the return of Issues Etc.
It's great to be with you guys on Issues Etc. Welcome back. A lot of us across this country are really thankful to be hearing your voices again. It's always great to be with you guys.
We're talk radio for the thinking Christian, Issues Etc. Listen live or on demand at www.issuesetc.org.
Science lessons, then needed in the church.
Answers with Ken Ham, co-author of the anti-racism book, Darwin's Plantation, Evolution's Racist Roots.
You know, I agree with many Christians who say that the church has to rethink how it's to effectively reach the culture. We generally do a good job of preaching and teaching what the Bible says about morality, for example, but increasingly, the world's not listening. Why is that? I believe that the church has largely forgotten to apply 1 Peter 3:15. You see, Christians need to give answers. They need to be able to defend their faith when it's under attack. And where's the Bible under attack today? Well, by secular science. You see, the church can't just teach Bible stories. Christians have to show that there are reasonable answers to the attacks people hear constantly about the Bible at their school or job. For example, we often hear how fossils and other evidence of science supposedly disproves the history in the Bible. It's time the church started teaching the answers to science questions, not just to spiritual or moral questions, so people can defend their faith and proclaim the Bible with authority.
Indeed, the Bible is authoritative in every area that it touches, from history to science. That's one of the themes of a book co-authored by Ken Ham called War of the Worldviews. We'll send it to you after your gift of any amount as we close out this week. Call us toll-free at 1-888-89-ANSWERS or go to the web, answersoffer.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, talking with Jennifer Roback Morse about the economic crisis and family-friendly economic policies. Bob in Newport, Vermont writes this, Jen. He says, during the Clinton administration, pressure was put on lenders to extend credit to potential borrowers who would tend otherwise to be rejected. Differential rates of loan rejection were seen as racial discrimination. How much of this fiscal debacle can be attributed to the abuse of the Community Reinvestment Act?
Well, that's a very, very good point. And I don't have an answer for him in terms of the percentage, but I know for a fact that that is a large element of this crisis. That, in fact, it's not just that people at random were making loans to people that couldn't pay them back, but that, in fact, it was the policy to encourage people to get more people into housing, including people who had really no real prospect of ever being able to pay it back. And so, therefore, those policies, the particular ones that he mentioned from the Clinton years, the continuing policy of that in the early years of the Bush administration, carried on by Freddie Mac, and Fannie Mae. That is exactly what was going on. It was a policy of let's get everybody into home ownership, whether they can pay back or not. Now, one of the interesting things about that is that in some cases, people who took out these loans that they had very little prospect of being able to pay back, in point of fact, they for some of them, they haven't lost that much. In other words, if you can't pay your mortgage and you stop paying your mortgage and you end up being foreclosed on, these are people who no longer have any equity in their house anyway. The reason people are walking away from their homes is because they bought in at the peak of housing prices, thinking that housing prices would continue to go up. They made payments for a while. Then when their loans changed and the price of the housing fell, the value of the home fell, it no longer made any sense to keep paying. So those are people who basically paid rent. They didn't build up any equity in the home the way you normally do when you make a mortgage payment. They, in effect, paid rent and then lived in their houses maybe for a year or 18 months before they were foreclosed, basically paying nothing in some cases. By the time you're foreclosed, you have paid nothing for quite a while. That's usually the way it works. In order to actually get kicked out of your house, it takes a while. So in a sense, some of these people didn't really lose anything. And that's something to think about. You know, in other words, the people who appear to be the worst off, in a sense, didn't lose very much in the way of capital. It's the people in between, the people who actually invested something in their homes and then the value of the homes dropped, and who would have had equity had the price of the homes been stable. Those are the people, in a sense, who have more at stake in this thing and who actually lost more.
Okay, in the few minutes left to us, let's just get a quick tally of some of the policies that you think the government should either continue or implement that would benefit the family in a tangible way to support the formation and the continuation of the traditional family. What would your short list be, Jen?
Well, you need to support married couple parents. You know, I mean, I think that's really important. And what that means is not giving credits for child care, but basically giving credit for the children, for the fact that you have the children. And it needs to be structured so that it's more beneficial to be married than not married. In this country, the biggest marriage penalty is for people at the lowest income level, that because if people get married, they lose various benefits and so on. And that kind of stuff just absolutely has to stop. There are a number of people who are aware of that and who realize that that's a problem, and I would hope the next round of welfare reform would focus on that. But the main thing is really to get some money into the hands of the family that they can spend themselves as they see fit, rather than targeting child care for those who work outside the home or even home ownership for those who own homes rather than rent. It's just better to make sure people have the money in their hands and then they can allocate it as they see fit. So overall tax reform that keeps the taxes lower and that gives you credit for having children inside the family, inside the married couple. Those are the kinds of things that are simple, straightforward, and really need to happen.
Jennifer Roback Morse is a regular guest here on Issues Etc., founder of the Ruth Institute based in San Diego. She spent 15 years teaching economics at Yale University and George Mason University. She's authored the books Love and Economics and Smart Sex. You can find out about these books and the Ruth Institute on the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Click on demand. Jennifer, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you.